I was about to say that. It's on the Gorkonaut, but obviously that would have been wrong.
Webway has finally brought you here. Behold, Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined by Red Powell.
Hello.
And Adam Camilleri.
Evening.
We are the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. Thanks for joining us. Hope everybody's doing all right today. You know, there's been some cool things. We got more orc leaks from the Warhammer community site. We got what might be an unintentional leak of a new Heresy Sons of Horus, a Praetor model.
Yeah, dude, looks sick. And funny story how it came about. I don't know if you guys know what the story is.
Well, I've heard it. I don't know how much is urban myth at this point.
I haven't heard it.
It's only been a week. But
so, yes, apparently someone ordered Maglehurst. Maglehurst, is that how you say it?
Yeah.
I've never actually, I don't know if I've ever said his name out loud.
Said it out loud. I think that's it. That's the way I refer to him.
Yeah. And apparently got this new Praetor in the clan pack instead. Now, I'm not sure if this clan pack was listed as, you know, Sons of Horus Praetor or as Maglehurst. But he got this model instead. Posted it up on Instagram being like, you know, what the, please explain. And kind of, I don't know if it's forced G-Dub's hands in putting out the article stating he's, you know, this guy's coming, but certainly they did a note there saying if you were lucky enough to get one by accident, good for you, you can keep it or you can return it and get the actual model you're after. And I doubt anybody's gonna return it.
Dang, I feel like I need to go order that model now.
Just get two or three. It's like
lottery. Yeah,
Pokemon deck cards. You just got to get the maybe get the rare one.
That dude is gorgeous.
He really does. He looks beef. I mean, he looks sizable, if you ask me.
Yeah, he looks considerably bigger than the regular lads. But maybe, I don't know, that could just be a trick of the pictures.
It could be a trick of the scale. So you think this might be just a little bit of, it's a leak but not a leak? Like maybe somebody did this on purpose?
Well, they didn't release it. I don't know the guy who they released it, who got it, but apparently he's not a nobody, social media wise. So maybe this was a little bit of gamesmanship by G-Dub. Maybe it's a little bit of a, we'll just let this little bit out, create a bit of hype. Why not? Maybe it's a new tactic by them. Or maybe this is just a mistake, you know?
I'm doing a little bit of detective work. I've often thought that the first leak we got of Magnus was just a little too suspicious.
That's fair.
And so, you know, maybe this is occasionally you just pull this trick out of the bag every now and then. I don't know if that's true, but.
Well, I think if they're going to do it for any game system, doing it for Heresy makes the most sense.
It's a fun story either way.
Yeah. Heresy players love to lament how little support they get. And so little stuff like this, just to show there's some stuff in the pipeline, can keep a lot of fires, a lot of embers burning for being passionate about that game.
And we
which I play, by the way, and it's a phenomenal game.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that in just a minute if you want. But we also got the Thousand Suns like kind of teaser saying what's coming with an interesting looking Chaos Sorcerer.
Yeah, he's a bit unique, isn't he? I think he's the, I don't want to call it too early, but he seems like he's the equivalent of a chaplain. He gives out like priestly buffs, and, you know, psychically priestly buffs, also, so to speak.
Well, so the Infernal Masters are sorcerers of the Thousand Suns who specialize in demonology, enabling them to strike bargains with the powers of the warp to secure otherworldly aid. So I guess take that for whatever.
Is anyone going to do the baby shark, baby screamer thing?
So one of the things that got listed here is the Capering Imps. If this pact is successful, select one enemy unit within 24 inches and visible to this Infernal Master until the start of your next command phase. That unit cannot receive the benefits of cover, cannot fire Overwatch, and cannot set to defend. So maybe they don't buff, maybe they debuff. Who knows? We'll see. But I do like the little baby screamers in the warp coming here.
I like everything about this model except for the tactical rock. Leave it at home. Less tactical rock.
Well, you gotta take it for, like, I mean, think of the old, you know, Chaos Terminator Sorcerer. You know, you could either make the Chaos Terminator Lord or the Chaos Terminator Sorcerer. And I think he's kind of got that feeling going on. I mean, I think size and scale, I'd be interested to see this model up next to that, because he does look bigger than your average Chaos Space Marine, in my opinion. And I think that that's been something we're starting to see. You know, we talk about the scale and everything of the how they're looking at increasing with the Firstborn models and that Heresy model that was, you know, kind of leaked, previewed, and then look at this guy. Like, I bet you, and there's something to his stance and everything. It's kind of like an updated version of that Chaos Terminator Sorcerer to a certain extent. I think it's pretty cool. I really like the direction they went with it.
I loved that Chaos symbol, Tactical Rock, on that the kit you're talking about.
Oh yeah, that was a good rock. There's a lot of uses for that rock outside of just that one model.
Yeah,
I'm waiting to just see somebody do a display board for like Adepticon or something, and it's just nothing but like a 2-foot by 2-foot tile with tactical rocks on it. That's just the whole thing. All see, your tactical rock requirements.
We've talked a little bit about this before. I actually like this because when it's your army and it gives you like a little bit of extra oomph for your character models to stand out. So when people are walking by them, it only kind of gets, I think you'd only notice it to the degree that you're noticing it if there were, you know, 5 of the same characters or 5 of the same armies lined up all in the same row, which is unlikely.
You're playing Harlequins or Dark Eldar, in which case every character you have is on a tactical rock.
Oh, fair. That's fair.
But you're right. And it's only like by looking at it from afar. Like, I'm reviewing these things, you know, of models I don't own most of the time because I can't afford to go out and buy every model. And so, yeah, I'm a bit harsh on the rock. Very harsh on the rock. But I just don't like it that every time I see a new character, I automatically look to see what kind of rock they're pivoting off, because they're just about all of them are.
Red can maybe correct me on this, but if when you're looking at rocks in that quantity, you're probably looking at strategic rocks.
That's true.
Well, you know, when you talk about the breadth and depth of it all, I mean, you're tactical rocks, right? I mean, like, okay, so it's that. But when you're really going for something as big and you're playing into this much bigger deal, and you also account for the fact that your GW is giving you terrain for not just terrain, but like they're basing your model for you. That's part of the magic. They really are. Like, that's, there's a significant advantage to this that I don't think should be discounted. When you start considering like strategic benefits for your army, I mean, we're talking, you know, height and everything that's added to it. There's just a lot going on. I mean, consider, I'm going to go back because I have to. I feel I've, especially since the release, I don't think you guys have caught on yet, but I'm trying to mention the Tanith models in every single episode so far.
And tactical when you, stick, see?
Yeah, exactly. GW is giving us basing material with the models. I can't complain. Like, I'm not gonna just give everything to GW, because there's plenty of things that I know we could probably say that they could improve or go forward with. But Adam, I mean, at least give it to them that they're helping you base your model. Come on.
Okay, I love how legit you made that. You made that rebuttal sound, so yeah. I will give it to you.
Gonna have to.
You actually did a great job.
So, do you remember when the Thousand Suns came out? Those new models, and they were slightly taller, you know, than the mm-hmm. other Chaos Space Marines equivalent. And we thought that because, you know, those are the giants, they're actually in the lore. Mm. I think I'm remembering this right. In the lore, they are in some, you know, I think by and large, see what I did there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they are a little bit taller. Now, it just turns out they're matching, you know, kind of scale of the Primaris Marines is what it seems like.
I think in the lore it's the Thousand Suns are the physically tallest, and I think it's either Sally's or some reason I think it's Iron Hands are up there as well, but I think Sally's were one of the biggest as well.
Yeah, fair enough. But you look in this this Heresy Praetor, it does appear like the legs might be a little bit longer and the torso might be a little bit longer.
Yeah, one of the things I always noticed, especially when Primaris Marines came out, all of a sudden my Firstborn Marines, their forearms seemed really long all of a sudden. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just their chest is a bit too close together or whatnot. And please don't say I think I'm hating on Firstborn Marines. They are my bay. They will always be. And but yeah, all of a sudden they looked, the structure of them, their literal size and the way they're made up and things just looked a little bit off in comparison. I'm actually looking at an Eradicator right now. I've been building some. And yeah, they... perfect. But their torso is a lot longer than their Firstborn guys in comparison, I think.
Yeah, now you say you play Heresy and painted your Dark Angels like with the pre-Heresy color scheme.
I painted all my Dark Angels with the pre-Heresy color scheme. Even the 40K ones. They're all black with some spot red, and one day somehow get around to doing and having the will to put checkers on them all.
Oh, I was about to ask if you had checkers, but totally makes sense. I get it now, Adam. You don't have checkers. Okay.
I don't have checkers, no. I'm weak. It's fair. Because you know what happens, though? You get yourself, because I'm a filthy tournament player, and I'll set my sight on a 2,000-point army and try and get to that 2,000-point place as quickly and efficiently and with as good a product and as good an end result as I can. And then usually I'll go back and I'll do transfers and things. But once you get to 2,000 points and you have to go back and do things like checks and dags, you're just like, the flesh is weak, you know?
Dude, but see, that's okay, though. I use that. I mean, you could do the same thing, is that when it comes time for a tournament and you already have it, you just luck into the fact that everything you need for that tournament is already painted. Mm-hmm. That's your opportunity to go put some checkerboards or whatever on, or some extra level of detail on a unit that doesn't have it.
There are some really good check transfers out there for those of you wanting. A lot of them are for acrylic nails, for usually for fingernails.
Yep.
And some of those transfers are phenomenally well sized and detailed for 40k models, 30k models.
I think there's some checkerboard patterns on ultramarine decals as well.
Yeah, there are. I've actually been stockpiling them for that day I find the will. But yeah, we'll see. But yeah, like I've got somewhere in the region of like about 6,000, 7,000 points of the Heresy era scheme. The way I justified that, because I justified it to myself in the fluff. As soon as Rowboat woke up, as soon as we had Magnus and Mortarion, I'm like, yeah, look, the line's probably awake now. There's no way that he, someone would whisper in his ear and be like, Robot's awake, and he wouldn't wake up.
A thousand years.
Exactly. There's no way he would stay asleep when Gilliman's up running things. He'd be just like, I am outraged. Get out of the way.
Remember when he got too big for his britches in Unremembered Empire?
Yeah.
Not today.
Not today, man.
I'm looking forward. So, there was the release we were just talking about, the sneak peek of this Praetor was off of the release of Maglehurst. So, there's some more attention getting put on the game. So, maybe a little love on the rule side.
Man, I have, especially in Australia, I don't know what the Heresy scene is like over there, but in Australia, the Heresy scene is like a really tight-knit group. And the most amazing thing about them is they always are pushing each other hobby-wise, like, to hold each other to the highest standards of stuff. It's really amazing. But there's very little, from my experience, which is not, I'm not crazy into it. I am more 40K than 30K. But there's very little gatekeeping. Everyone's always willing to help. This is how you pull off a great, black for your Iron Hands. And this is how, if you want to not have, just a flat black, here's how to do so many other things. That's how I learned how to do the black for my lads. I actually, a lot of people have different schemes for it. Mm-hmm. Instead, I just went out and got I think it's a P3 paint. I think it's sea green. And I just used that as like a, almost like a pre-shade over pre-shade, and just to put a little tinge of green onto my black. And it's really made it really unique and one of the first things that made me excited about painting that scheme.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I think finding a way that works for you to paint with those difficult colors. And black, you think, oh, well, it's just black. Come on. It's a very difficult color to make look good. And you got to find something that works for you that you can repeat. Over the course of however many models you have to do.
Exactly right. And this was really intimidating for me going into Heresy, because I thought I knew the quality of what some of the other armies would be. And I'm like, well, I want my stuff to look that good. And then when I started asking around, everyone was only too happy to, give me all the trade secrets.
That's really awesome. Let's talk about that for a minute. Is that basically the environment that you were going into, you knew had I don't want to say rigid, but a high hobby standard, and that influenced what you wanted to bring to the table.
Yeah, it did. And I don't necessarily need my army to look better than, or want my army to look better than my opponents when I rock up next to them. But if someone has put in a huge amount of effort into their army, I want mine to look like they could be going toe to toe. You don't see pictures of you don't imagine the Horus Heresy with a very beautiful, clean cut ultramarine next to, a gray sprue Iron Hand, and the reason I think Heresy is so attractive is because the lore is so rich. And so you want to represent as much of the lore on the table as you can. I think that's where it gets the really nice joining and meeting of the minds.
Oh, that is one of the neatest things about that, is that the lore and the narrative and the units and the purpose of all the units work their way into the tabletop. And then all the different characters that you can pick really, not name characters, but just act as kind of like personality focal points for the army itself. That's, I think, one of the beautiful things about the Horus Heresy game.
100%. And the fact is, some armies thematically are just a bunch of Marines, and you got to find a way to make that an enjoyable thematic experience, and not just like, okay, here's my 80 tactical Marines I need to play this army from this battle that I really love, and
you just put you gotta make that on them all, and then they're world eaters, right, Red?
That's right. I mean, it's not that hard. And, you know, it's really easy to just jump right in there, take a little bit of blood for the blood god, technical blood, you know, put it on a toothbrush or something, and you can just spackle that entire model in blood. Real quick way to put your model right onto the Crimson Path there.
It's not wrong, except for painting white at some point to make that, underneath that white.
I do like the World Eater's pre-heresy color scheme. I think that white and blue combination is pretty good.
Well, I just think like it's a genius pick to paint them that, and then to have everybody know what they turn out as. Be like, is this a blue and white scheme for the guys who are going to be the filthiest gore splattered dudes? Here's his blank canvas for all that gore.
So I think that's actually part of the coolest thing about it, just that real transition and just how much they went from one to the next, right? Because they were, before they became the World Eaters, they were the Warhounds, right? And the white and blue and this kind of like Centurion-esque appeal and that transition that they went into. And then like as you read into the heresy books and you start to see the devolving, the as they sink further into chaos and they start appearing as just, I mean, they didn't really go out and paint that armor initially, right? Like they were coated and saturated in gore, and that's what brought them to that. And now they are stained from there. It's a pretty remarkable transition, like almost no other legion. I think very few had such drastic transitions. Even the Sons of Horus from the Luna Wolves, I mean, I understand, you know, they changed the entire legion out, but very few others, I would argue, made such a drastic transition. The Dark Angels going from
Death Guard, there's a bit of that.
Death Guard, I could see Death Guard with their physical changes.
Well, no, the Dusk Raiders, they were Dusk Raiders before. They were like a gray and a burgundy shoulder, and then they
I think that's a good,
then they go to white.
They went to that kind of pale white with dark green.
I mean, maybe not as drastic of a transition, but it was a complete
white
armor
and blue
overhaul.
That's true.
Yeah, but I always
white and blue.
I really
to red
always,
and gold.
Yeah,
I really always found the Dark Angels color transition interesting. Like, I mean, I understand they started off as literally just being painted black. They were the Black Princes. They were essentially the first Legion. They were the prototype, and they, you know, fought on Terra and stuff in the Unification Wars before they were even Legiones Astartes. There was just the Legion, and then when they changed their stuff green, they changed their stuff green after Caliban fell. And Caliban falling is the worst thing that ever happened to that legion. Like, worse than the Emperor dying was Caliban, you know. And, Emperor's not dead, quotation marks. And, but it was just so funny to me that they would want to represent that. And what the Lion would think about that when he woke up, he'd slap them around and just be like, are you idiots? They tried to kill us. Why would we want to represent them? And yeah, really good.
How's that got to do with their armor?
Because they changed to green when he wasn't there. He was already, like, you know, in stasis and disappeared when they changed to green. And so they did it literally without his consent, without his knowledge. And I thought that was a really interesting thing. They could, if they ever wanted to tell that story, it would be really, really interesting.
That's neat. Yeah, I wasn't sure what the catalyst for them changing their armor was.
I don't think it's ever truly been explained, apart from them wanting to, you know, give homage to Caliban. And I thought that it's interesting they want to give homage to the guys who turned on him, ones who actually betrayed him.
That's kind of funny. You know that this was back in Rogue Trader, they just happened to have black armor. And then in some white dwarf later on, they just happened to get green armor. And yet we get to talk about it.
I think that they actually changed in part. I mean, I thought, if I remember correctly, you know, they did all that lore, which is some amazing material for the Horus Heresy, for the you know, the game itself, the book. What was that, book 9, that with the Thramis Crusade and everything? I was pretty sure that it later comes out. I mean, they had to divest themselves from the Fallen. I thought that was part of it. They did it internally, right?
Like, I may be mistaken, because the
entire, you know, everybody that was Fallen retained like the black armor in a lot of cases. Yeah. And the way that they were picked up and spread out, you know, they reappeared other places wearing black armor. And I don't think the Dark Angels were very like upfront on why they changed to green, because obviously they're not going to tell everybody because they're really ashamed of the whole Fallen concept.
Well, most people don't even know the Fallen exist. Force or whatever out there.
Red. And you just broke my brain. Either I read that and forgot it, or I am not the Dark Angels guru I thought I was. That makes a lot of sense.
I may be mistaken,
but I was pretty sure there is a lot of lore, and you really got to connect the dots across the different material, because you take a lot of the new stuff really as canon, but the writing, especially now in the Siege of Terra, is really, there's a lot of material there that can definitely catch people off guard as the writers and the authors continue to surprise us with new material coming through. So I may be off, and I apologize in that case. But I thought I was pretty sure that that was part of the reason why they split. I mean, we all understand, you know, Deathwing and the White, and that, and the Ravenwing, obviously, like that's a pretty clear distinction. But yeah, I did think that that was part of the separation to the dark green. So
and there were 100%. Oh, sorry, Cannibalite-born Dark Angels were allowed to paint one of their pauldrons green. And so that was always there. There was always that homage to Caliban. If you were Caliban-born, you could, you know, let people know you were, if you were lame. But yeah. So it's always been there in the fluff, I guess. So, dude, and that is the perfect reason, if that is why. Maybe someone in the chat will point it out to me, and I'll have another book to read, which would be awesome.
Was that to separate themselves from the Terran-borns, or, like, originally?
I think that was part of it, right? Because yeah, part of there the, was a, their, yeah, the whole split part.
Because there was always two big camps. There was, you know, the old school old born guys who fought behind the Emperor, beside the Emperor, and helped kill the Thunder Warriors and stuff, and they're all, you know, hidebound old school guys thinking they're the OG and stuff. And then there's all the new school, you know, very much encapsulated by a Corswain, who was kind of thought to be the best of the Calibanite born guys, and he's always looked up to unanimously. And so there was always these two camps. There was the old school guys, because they'd been around for just so much longer and had done and seen so much stuff before the Alliance was even found. And that's why one of the biggest reasons there was that shift, there was that rift, because there was a lot of them that didn't respect the line anymore, especially after what he did to Luther and he exiled them and all that stuff. And there was the ones that would bend over backwards for him. And the ones that didn't have a huge love for him was because they already had essentially that love placed there by the Emperor. They were, you know, they adored the Emperor, they fought beside him, they respected him more than they respected the Lion, because they'd fought for him longer than they'd fought for the Lion.
What was it, like 70 years, 100 years or something before some of the Primarchs were found from the start of the Crusade?
Absolutely.
I can't remember exactly. Yeah. This may be where I'm misremembering some of the lore. But
no, there was some time. It was a matter of time. And you know, I believe the Alpha Legion twins were the final ones to be found, if I'm not off on that. But yeah, there was some significant time.
I apologize in advance. I bet people are listening to this going like, what on earth? No, it was 3 years. And we all know that...
Also, I'm actually, the book I'm reading at the moment is the Alpharius Primarch novel. I'm actually working my way through all of them. I did the Lion first, and then I've done Ferris Manus, I've done Perturabo, and I've done I'm doing Alpharius.
Ferris Manus is a pretty short book, I have to imagine.
Dang.
The reason I read Ferris Manus is because I know that he's deceased.
Don't get ahead of yourself.
Yeah, I know literally nothing about the guy. He's like one of those points where you want to know more, but you're like, but he's dead, so why should I invest? Dang. He's a good read. You get a lot of understanding about that dude.
Does he ever blow his top?
He's a cool.
Dang.
Man, this will not end, by the way. I should change the subject because Paul won't stop at this point.
No, it's okay. I want to hear more. If he's got more, please, Paul, don't hold back. I do have to say, I really liked in the Heresy, where essentially they make a determination that had they not taken out Ferris Manus, that the siege on Terra would have been... Like, it was already a give and take. Like, they weren't confident that they were going to be able to make it, but they were going to push for it. But if Ferris Manus had survived, they probably wouldn't have been able to do it. And that's, you know, not all the Primarchs would admit to it, but there is a conversation at a point later down in the books that they kind of, you know, make their way around that assessment without making too much of a point of it. They're just kind of relieved that they don't have to worry about it, because Ferris Manus was just that kind of leader. So
well, that book's really interesting. It has a really interesting snapshot of what happens, because it's a little bit of time before Ulanor, but most of the galaxy is conquered. Like, most of it's conquered. The, you know, Horus is the man, and, you know, everyone else is kind of chasing Horus's kind of war tally because he's the most successful, he's the diplomat, everyone loves him, etc. And it's kind of, the whispers are starting to come out that the Emperor is thinking about retiring from the Crusade. He's thinking about leaving someone in charge. And so there's this drive from the guys who are like, who think they're as good as Horus to kind of match him and to try and be as glorious and as amazing as him. Guys like Gilliman, guys like Sanguinius, guys like, you know, Ferris, have this drive that they want to be as recognized, they want to be as good as Horus, and have that option to be named War Master, even though they didn't know it was going to be called War Master at the time. It's just a really cool concept to think about, is this juggernaut Primarchs, these unstoppable, you know, beings, and they are still having these petty, like, internal, very human qualities about them, which I like a lot.
It's going way over my head, guys. We need to bring it back down.
You don't have another, you don't have another headless...
Have you read any of these books, though, Paul? Have you read any of the Primarch books?
Not the ones we talked about. No.
The Alpharius one is amazing, and I don't want to spoil it, but the Primarchs weren't found in the order that you think they were.
Mm, that's fair. Nice. What did you think, Adam, of the Iron Warriors?
I was impressed. I've always thought Perturabo has been interestingly written. The same as the Lion. I think the Lion and Purdy are the two that I think have been written the most inconsistently over time, if I was to put it mildly. The Lion was written and was with very little character at the start. He was very aloof. You know, no one really knew what his qualities were apart from being prideful.
Well, those early Dark Angel books were like they received a lot of criticism because they didn't necessarily fit with the flow of what the other Heresy books is. Like they were almost like fantasy novels.
Yeah, there was that quality to them. Maybe that was the, you know,
I think it was a stylistic choice. I'm not commenting whether or not they were good or bad. I just know they received criticism.
Well, there is kind of a fable, kind of a Brothers Grimm thing going with the Dark Angels. There is that kind of, you know, Caliban is kind of the fables, the old terrors in the dark woods kind of stuff. And so that would make sense if they try and push more of those fantasy aesthetics into it. But yeah, in Perturabo, I feel like, apart from maybe Lorgar, has been written to be petulant and moody and, you know, not to be respected or liked. And so I wanted to find out if that was how he's being represented now. And they got him so dead on, you know, he's calculated. Oh, sorry, this is the reason I went into Perturabo is because I listened to Talan, the audiobook Talan, before that, because I'm a Treadhead and I love Imperial Guard. And it was a freaking amazing book. It was a phenomenally good book.
If people don't know this, 100% of the cast on the show plays Guard. So there's a...
Yeah. Mm. So as much as I got pumped for Guard, I got pumped for Iron Warriors as well. And I was like, I want to learn more about Perturabo and the Iron Warriors. So I listened to his Primarch novel. I was like, geez, this guy is meticulous. He's cold. He's brutal. He's, you know, and unlike what I thought before, he's to be respected and revered, but you're not supposed to like him. And they do that so very well. And I like it a lot. And I thought they wrote him extremely, extremely well.
I've started to like him as well.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, yeah, just to where I thought he was, like in a couple of the earlier books, I thought that he, you know, didn't get a good shake. I think they played too much into the resentment of Dorne, but maybe you needed that as a base to get us to where we are now. I think he's had a journey as a character that I really appreciate.
Mm. I hear the one of the reasons that this came up on my radar was after listening to Talan, some of my mates who are up to date with the Siege of Terror were telling me how there's been this pivotal change in his character development.
I don't want to spoil anything because it's like the most recent books, but it's real good and people will enjoy the portrayal, I think, of that character. Or you'll hate him more, but for the right reasons. You know what I mean?
Nah, spot on. I don't think I could have said it better. But yeah, I found that stuff really exciting. Whenever I see those arcs coming to fruition, I just find this desire to know more.
Nice. Speaking about knowing more, why don't we take a break and we'll come back and talk a little bit about what we've seen about the orcs coming up from the Warhammer community site.
Sweet.
See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. It's just me and Adam right now. Red had to step out, but he'll be back next week, hopefully along with Tanya as well.
Busy man, Red. A lot of responsibilities. We're very lucky to have him.
Yeah, absolutely. Glad he could put the time in when he did. You know, we mentioned we want to talk about orcs, and I want to do it. So there's an article up on the Warhammer community site talking about the orc vehicles, and there's a couple of interesting things in here. Ramshackle getting a big change. Ramshackle currently roll a d6 each time this model suffers a damage, suffers damage from an attack that has a damage characteristic of more than one. On a 6, reduce the damage caused by that weapon, by the attack, to 1.
Yeah, it's cute. It didn't come up that often. Like, if you're shooting in a truck, usually you're shooting enough stuff at that truck to kill that truck. And, like, rolling 1-6 on your, you know, 7 or 8 dice isn't going to save it. Can sometimes be frustrating, but this new rule is a billion times better. And it's something I think most armies are getting access to now, like... I mean, even sisters have some -1 damage stuff. So just reading this out, each time an attack is allocated to this model, unless that attack has a strength characteristic of 8 or more, subtract 1 from the damage characteristic of that attack. So that's pretty much what everyone gets on
to a minimum of 1. It does mention that just in case for
praise be Morvenval, you know, and Celeste. But it's weird. It's got the strength 8 caveat on top. I'm interested to see that. I wonder if that's something that's going to be added to things like Dreadnoughts later down the line, because it isn't obvious. differentiation?
Well, I could see that, you know, it's held together, I guess, by, you know, orc faith. You know.
That's true.
And so maybe they've got that strength element, is that it's a little bit of theme wrapped in there as well.
So isn't it funny that we have, like, we have word bearers, we have, you know, we have Black Templars and Sisters, and none of their faith is comparable to orcs. Orcs are the faith-bound faction, the faith-bound species, you know? I mean...
One of the coolest things about orcs is that, and this is a story that I hear from people, when people, they don't know that I know about orcs, and so they'll start to talk to me about orcs. The story, their go-to story is almost always, oh, it's so cool, an orc can find, you know, a rusted out las gun sitting in the middle of the desert. And, you know, it doesn't even have a magazine in it, and they can pick it up. And because they believe in the WOG, it will still fire.
And be like AP2 or something crazy as well.
Everyone knows that. That's a fact that everyone that knows anything about orcs knows.
Everyone loves that about orcs. I think that's been the, literally, apart from some of the Horus Heresy stuff and the Siege of Terra stuff, that's been the best plot development. Because that wasn't the story of orcs when I was growing up. Probably when you were a kid as well, orcs were just like, they just slapped the stuff together and found what they could. They were like, you know, very much Mad Max-like. In the way that things operated, you know, scrounging and scrapping and doing what they got to do.
I don't know. I think that was original orc lore. I think they were mushrooms and had the power of faith to fire whatever they found in the dirt.
Really? Because I never remembered that as a kid. I only remember reading that in the last couple of years.
I could be wrong. Some of this stuff over time does blend together.
Dude, I could be wrong. Jeez, I've been wrong a couple times in this episode already, which I'm sure some people are happy about.
That's the benefit of a podcast, is that everyone can be at their desk or in their car or whatever and say, tell us how much they're wrong or we're wrong.
Yeah. Everyone likes it when you're wrong as well. No one really likes it when you're correct. No one ever points out when I'm correct, guys. Everyone ever points out when I'm wrong. It's fine.
We'll let you know when that happens. I'm kidding. Yeah. I'm kidding. Yeah. But please, in the comments, let us know when that bit of lore got introduced, if you happen to know it.
Is that just a thing they've always had? Some interesting things coming down. I mean, our man, or as you might know him as Val, he's going to love that the stomp is down by, what is it, 175 points to 675? So it's the same points as pretty much a Castellan for knights, which is cool. That's a good comparison to have.
So we don't know what the other things on it look like at this point, but it says, now much easier to fit a mighty Stompa into your force thanks to their new power rating, which drops from 46 to 34, and is a drop of 175 points in terms to 675.
And interesting change here for the Morkanauts and Gorkanauts. They're up from 18 wounds to 24, and they do a flat 6 damage with their claws in combat, which is nice. But this is an interesting thing, which I was really surprised. I've always been surprised about how GW has treated these two models, especially since they came out. So when they first got teased in 7th edition, everyone's like, oh, orcs are getting knights. This is going to be the best. And then they came out as, like, I guess a super deaf dread. And they just weren't there. Their guns weren't that good. They weren't super heavy, so they could be one shot by melter guns and las cannons.
They had
a
weird transport capacity with the ones you do. And so they just kind of, they struggled to find their place, I think, in many orc list.
Yeah, and they just seemed awkward straight away.
Despite
the models. Yeah. Man, you're flying with the puns today. Well done. but they just felt like they didn't make much sense, despite the model being freaking cool. I had two of them. I bought and made a Morkanaut and a Gorkanaut, magnetized both so I could have one of each, or two of each, sorry. And I was in love with the model straight away. And, you know, I painted up with all this chipping medium and I was experimenting with
I do love the model too, especially when it's like they have it in the picture here, standing next to the Stompa. You got your Def Dreads and stuff and Killicans.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it looks, you know, almost, what's that video game? I can't remember the exact, it may have been Armageddon, the video game or whatever, where I remember playing orcs and you had their big old war machines just, it would scoot across the battlefield, and very reminiscent of that when I see it, evokes the same joy I had playing that game back in the day.
And obviously the gentleman who's painted these ones, because their goss is better than me, because he actually has done his checkers.
Well, he had some pictures. You know, he had some pictures too.
It's true. But now they're Lords of War for the Gorkonaut and Morkonaut. They're up to 24 wounds, up from their 12. They look like they're finally going to be knights. Now, this does come with some compromises, with some issues, because we know what's happened with the Monolith for Necrons. The Monolith got a fantastic new model, superb-looking thing. And now I don't see it, because it's in the Lord of War choice, and it costs you 3 CP to take. Mm-hmm. I wish there was some way to make it cost-neutral to take one in, like, a battalion or whatnot, if you were, like, mono-faction or some mono-sub-faction or something like that, just to enable people to get them in, because I feel like it's a keynote flagship piece that I'd love to see on the table more often. Mm-hmm. And I hope these guys don't go down the same trail.
It's difficult to know whether or not the orcs are going to be thirsty for CP or not.
They
may be able to have it, or the trade-off because of these increased stats or flexibility because of they're pointed in a certain way to work them into a list make up for it. I don't know. It could still be difficult to get into a list, until we see the full composition of things. I think it's fun to think about, though, for sure. And the idea of the fact that there's been some attention on these, at least, that will hopefully make them more viable choices.
And what are we really saying here? It's orc players. They're going to take it no matter what. They're just going to be like, whatever. I'm just going to take whatever I want. And you know what? They're all correct.
And then roll sixes. And then
they roll sixes. For and days. Then
it's fine because they have the
fueled
by the power of Morgan exactly, Gork.
But do you know what? I've never had an unfun game against an orc player. I don't know if you ever have, but never, not once, ever. Even when orcs were like one of the hardest armies out there.
Looters in their heyday could be a little bit.
15 double shooting looters with rerolls and all that, and more darker and stuff. Even then, I was like, this is fine. They're orcs. Orcs are sick.
It's even better when they've got just a well-painted army. Like the details there, the personality from the character, from the figures themselves come out, and then you get to see the expression of the clan cultures in the paint schemes. It's one of those. It comes together.
Do you miss the wahs? Do you miss people yelling out their wah? I do. I think I do.
Yeah.
I miss being across the hall from somebody and just hearing the chorus go up. It's like a tidal wave. And you're like, that's the energy. That's the orc energy rising in the room. It's palpable. I love it.
Yep. Yep, indeed. And Nob Bikers were also a real stout.
Oh, back in 5th edition. Yeah, they were fearsome.
Yeah.
Or was it 6th edition?
5th is right, I think. Yep.
Yep.
4th, whenever Wound Shenanigans was the big thing.
Do you want to talk about the Hunter rig and the Kill rig a little bit? Because this one is the one that I complained about last week, saying, I'm not sure I'm with this model.
Yeah, sure.
And the stat line gets even funnier. Okay, paint this picture. We have a Doomsday Arc, We have a Doomsday Arc, we have a Baguette. I've done this comparison before. Literally a structure made of nothing but metal, living metal. So maybe you can argue it's a little bit less tough than just, straight wrought iron or cast metals or whatever. But that thing, toughness 6. We have the Hunter and the Kill rig, toughness 8. No armor to speak of on any of these dudes. Just some slapped on plates here, there, and everywhere, stuck together by literal hopes and dreams. Toughness 8.
I don't know. Okay, let's compare this thing on the front of it to a rhinoceros.
Yeah. Okay.
I think a rhinoceros is tough.
A rhinoceros. Yeah, it's tough. That is tough. It's probably got a leathery hide, probably, like taken on a crocodile of some kind. Very angry crocodile.
Everyone knows that Necron's bones are hollow.
They're bird-like.
That's another fun fact about Necrons. I'm kidding, of course.
I love it. But, toughness 6, not even toughness 7, and this thing gets toughness 8. I love it. It's so... No, things aren't supposed to make sense. Just take it. Adam, shut up. Just take it.
Well, this is... I think that the way that this army is going to come together, like, aesthetically on the table is going to be fun. I think there'll be... It seems to be like there's reason to take the people that've had Stompas. Maybe you get it in because it's a little bit cheaper. People that got the Beast Snaggas and like that, maybe you get those in because they're new and fancy. And then you've got some of your core to fall back on. Some bikers, the buggies, maybe if you've had them, you've been sitting on them since Speed Freaks.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's a lot to be said for the buggies as well. I think they're going to come out of this looking pretty good. But man, I think a lot of the new stuff they've got, I think, fills some gaps for them. Like, so the bikers, ever since the Nob days, the bikers have never really been that killy. And I reckon these Beastnagger guys are going to fill that niche. They're fast, you know, multi-damage punchiness, because that's kind of what they don't have. I mean, you can put Mega Knobs in a truck. Cool. You got three of them. Nice. When you get there, you know, maybe if they blow up the truck, you roll a one, one of them dies. All of a sudden, you can't really get the job done anymore. And they hit on fours, which always sucked. You had to take a knob with a white banner or other stuff. But I reckon these Beast Snaggers are going to fill that niche for you. They're going to go in. They're going to kill Marines for you. They're going to be multi-damage. They're just going to slap. They're going to be like your Juggernauts. What are the Juggernaut dudes? They're called Skullcrushers in fantasy. Never mind. Going down the wrong pipe. Mournfang Cav. They're going to be Mournfang Cav for 40k.
Hey, maybe so. I was talking about it earlier with the Speedwag. It is called vehicle-mounted assault weapons lose the penalty for advancing and firing, and DACA weapons get yet another extra shot. So,
nice.
I think the stuff that, at least what they're talking about is some of the things that I know a lot of Orc players have wanted to play, either because they look a certain way on the table or, you know, were just fun to put together and use, and, you know, maybe like some rules for it.
Yeah, I'm excited, man. So
what do you think of the DACA rule and stuff?
I think it's a clever rule. I think it's a nice little clever change. I'm just trying to pull it up now before I talk out of turn.
Da-da-da. Yeah, so DACA weapons have two values for the number of attacks they make. When a model shoots a DACA weapon, use the first value if the target is within half range of the weapon's range. If the target is not within half range, the weapon's range, use the second value instead.
Yeah. It's good. It's good. So it's like a pseudo rapid fire, but, you know, it's orcified. It's really, it's kind of cool.
Well, yeah.
And there'll be all sorts of wonky ones as well.
It's not, yeah, it's not double. So Mork's Roar, this is on the Morkonaut. I was about to say that. It's on the Gorkonaut, but obviously that would have been wrong.
Yeah, for sure.
As range 36, DACA 16/12, strength 5, neg 1, AP damage 1. Whereas that's previously nice. It was assault 12.
Yeah, that's nice. I'm a fan. Yeah, it looks pretty good. I did manage to track down the Squighog Boys and their stat line as well, which was originally also released by G-Dub. Movement 10, Weapon Skill 3, Bliss Skill 5, of course. Strength 5, Toughness 6, 3 wounds, 3 attacks, Leadership 6, 4 plus save. And this is what I meant about the their multi-damage. So they got each one of them, you know, comes with their sticker, I guess their spear, so to speak, which is strength user minus 2/2 damage, and that's the throw assault 12. And in combat, it is the same, strength plus 2 minus 2/2 damage. So it's strength 6 minus 2/2 damage with 3 attacks, and it's orcs. You've got to assume there's a bunch of ways to pump up those attacks. These guys, you know, could be 5 attacks base each. And then in addition, they also get one little grot attack at strength 3 minus 1, and then they get the Squighogs are biting down with another 2 attacks at strength 6 minus 1, 2 damage. So that, just to put that in perspective, that's a minimum of 5 strength 6 attacks, all with rand and all that 2 damage from each one without any buffs. These guys are going to slap.
That's like a squad of Lord Discordants.
Yeah, absolutely right. Or it's like a mounted Blade Guard. You know, Blade Guard on hogs. If you want to get crazy. But these guys are good.
Yeah. And even the humble shooter going to DACA 3/2.
So what are the, so 8, so 9 inches did you get 3 shots?
Yes.
Yeah, that's quite clever they've done that. So we have to wait and see if they keep the jump, but you know, I can't see them losing the jump. So that means if you do jump, you'll still be outside the 9, which is, you know, that's cool. So you can't just jump in and just 90 shot somebody with 30 boys.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know how much damage you're going to do with your BS being what it is, but, you know, I think we don't know how it's going to be, what every weapon has, but the DACA thing sounds right. If the orcs are getting in close and killy, then they're going to be able to be lethal.
Yeah.
Which I think, man, is exactly what you want.
Mm, spot on. Man, I think it's going to be a good world. So people talk about eras of the game, and, you know, we're going to be nostalgic or wistful or whatever right now. Well, I am. See if Paul joins in. But we talk about eras of the game being good or bad based on the aesthetic or the play style of the army that was best at the time. We talk about 6th edition being, you know, a bad edition because it was dominated by what we remember as Tau and Eldar in the same army. And if it went first, it pretty much beat everybody. And if it went second, it beat anybody who wasn't Tau Dar.
Unless you were
super friends, or you had
fun stories about running up under Tal'dar's day.
And then those cool stories come of it because you have this top dog, and anybody's able to like knock off the top dog, even for a day, is like a freaking hero. and goes down in legend. And so that's a cool counterpoint to those kind of, you know, down periods of the meta, so to speak. But whenever you look back on an era of the game where orcs are strong, it's never a bad era of the game, is it, mate? You never look back and be like, oh, I wish orcs weren't good back then. Just because they're a fun army. They are fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think the game is seemingly more fun. The tournaments have a nice just air to them when there's powerful bad guys. Including, you know, that could be Xenos. And okay, I shouldn't say bad as the label. When there are powerful non-Imperium armies.
That's a very diplomatic, and I approve of that as well. As an Imperial player, I think that's the right call.
It seems to just help with the energy of everything.
It does. It takes a lot of air out of a lot of people's sails for the right reasons. I'm saying these people are wrong, and usually they're right, and I was one of those people.
Oh, you get these great battles. You know, it's just hard battles. I mean, that's a contributing factor to it. But also, you see those folks that are just real fans of these factions come out and participate in more events, which is fun.
Yeah, agreed. And yeah, I mean, I can look back at times in the game when Tau's been super strong, when things like Death Stars have been super strong, like the Bark Star and all that nuts stuff at the end of the 7th edition. And even last edition, with Iron Hands, and we had Yanari and stuff. And those armies were built on, I don't want to say unfun mechanics, but beating your opponent so hard they didn't get to play much of the game. 9th edition isn't as bad. Admech, maybe at times, especially if you don't have enough terrain, can be just as punishing. But Drakari isn't. I definitely don't think Orcs will be either. If Orcs are smashing me and getting into combat with me turn one, that's going to be a fun game. Just put it out there. And Paul's going to scramble straight away and get his red pen and voice back on the table. Because he's like, yes.
Oh, you're coming close? Oh, sounds good. Sounds pretty good. Yeah. I know you mentioned the stats of the Squigog boys, but they've got, this snake bite culture, which these beast snaggas don't have to be snake bites, from what I understand.
Yeah.
But the what we got the old ways, each time a squig model with this culture makes a melee attack, if that model's unit made a charge move or performed heroic intervention this turn, add one to that attack's wound roll.
So that's interesting. We don't have the breakdown for those rules. Does that apply just to the squig's attacks, or is that anybody who's got the keyword squig?
So I have no idea. Yeah, we don't know what the keywords are.
Yeah. It makes you interesting. It makes you want to read, want to learn more, because I want to learn more.
Yeah. And here's something in there. We learned squigs can also do so much more. So, yeah, this codex is sounding orkier and orkier with everything that I read, and I'm here for it. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I'm also really happy that a lot of different armies are getting this little patch onto their range, like Admech did. Admech got this little patch stuck onto their range where they got their range of units increased by a certain percent. Maybe it's about 20-30% for Orcs, because I already had a really fleshed out range. Necron's got the same. Admech got the same. I like seeing it from GW, adding more thematic elements, adding more intriguing ways to play, and more diversifying the roles of different units. I think it's clever what they're doing.
Yeah, indeed. Well, let's if we can, can we jump to the hobby segment next?
No, sure.
Well, last week we talked about starting a new project and how to be realistic with yourself. And actually, the more I thought about this, I do try to put some thought into these topics that are on the show. But the more I thought about it, I thought that actually probably the focus of the hobby segments that we're going to talk about is being realistic about what your goals are and what you can accomplish. I think especially after coming off of last year where, maybe not everyone got to do what they wanted to do. And then that problem, it could have compounded on itself of, kind of like a snowball effect of, we're just not getting anything done. And I think that can contribute to even more of not getting stuff done. So the more real you can be with yourself on these things, planning out things, which you're actually capable of doing. And then if you don't meet those goals, don't be so hard on yourself. Then it's going to make it a lot more easier when you sit down the next time to do it. And I've got an example of this that I'll share. I know I've talked about this in the past, but I'll mention it again. So I, every now and then, I'm like, let me just paint up a squad. I'm in between hobby projects. Let me paint up a squad of something, some troop choice, a couple years ago, I did demons. I sat down and I painted 30 plague bearers in the span of 2 or 3 days. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty easy. At the end of a week, I could have, basically all the core from a Nurgle army just ready to go. So yep. Then I thought, if I did it that easy, I didn't do that, by the way, because 2 days later, I was like, I bet I could do the same thing with bloodletters.
Mm.
And I sat down and I built the bloodletters, got 30 bloodletters. letters ready to go. And then I hit the wall. I got about 5 or 6 blood letters in, and I'm like, whoa, something is different here. Either I couldn't focus enough, or I wasn't enjoying painting them enough, or as much as I did the others. The colors weren't coming together. You know, I wouldn't enjoy them because the colors weren't coming together. It wasn't looking like I thought they needed to look in my mind. I don't actually know. I didn't spend too much time unpacking it. I just knew that I wasn't able to get the same success that I got with the Plague Bearers. And yeah, I had to really kind of pump the brakes a bit and figure out, you know, what, how do I succeed at that point? So instead of painting 30 in 2 days, I then decided to just paint 5 every 2 days. And I eventually got through the whole squad.
Awesome.
I did the same thing with Pink Horrors after Contrast came out. I'd heard that, oh man, Contrast is a great product. The Pink Horrors, there's a color that's pink, sounds kind of zinchy. Let's just get to work. When I couldn't make the contrast work the exact way that I thought it should work, you know, because while it is, I think, kind of romantic to say that it works great right out of the bottle, it doesn't work great right out of the bottle for every application.
Yep.
And the look that I was going for needed a little bit more finagling. I won't even say finesse because it's not a finesse. It wasn't a finesse thing for me. It was just to get the look that I wanted, the translucent color that I wanted, I needed a little bit more work on it.
Mm.
And when things were going wrong, or at least not the way that I wanted to, I think it would have been potential impetus to stop. And so what I decided to do was try to get realistic, and I'll go back to the blood letters here. But Demons for a while was just my go-to. If I was in between hobby projects, I'm like, let me just throw together a squad of demons and paint them and have them ready. You know, you never know. I play Chaos. You know, sometimes you just want to bring in some demons. At least that was my mentality. So with this, I'll try to stay on topic, but being realistic about what I could accomplish, because nothing changed about me wanting to have the finished squad.
Yeah.
But there are times when I wanted to stop.
Mm.
And I had to find ways to figure out how do I reroute, how do I continue to let my desire to have the painted squad override my desire to want to stop.
So what's the solution? Is the solution just to rearrange your expectations, slow down, take it easy, or find a different mode of managing? Because you didn't stop, did you? You didn't stop.
No, I didn't stop. Got these squads completed. And I mean, to something that I'm satisfied with. But I think that was it. I had to redefine what my success for the time period that I was willing to put in was, and then be realistic about what time I could put in. And now this is not, I'm not talking about like tournament driven crunch time. Like sometimes you have no choice but to have something done if you want to use it, you know, but in that case, your desire to want to use it and perform with it on the tabletop is overriding your any reason to stop. And I think trying to figure out how those pathways, you know, whatever fires off that reward buzzers and whistles in your brain or whatever, different for everybody. Yeah. But I think being realistic about what those are, what those drivers are, and then what you can accomplish if you kind of treat yourself with fairness, and fair is a charged word, and I don't use it very often, but you can certainly do it, use it as it applies to yourself. Treat yourself fairly, be realistic about what can be done, what you want done, then you may not short circuit yourself along the way and actually get more done. And it may help you kind of manufacture that motivation, or at least not turn yourself off when it's not there.
My main one is to never stop. I don't know if that's healthy for people, but I always have some kind of hobby on the go. Like I bought 2 boxes of Eradicators with some vouchers and some stuff. And I've been building them literally over a week. Like I'll build like one a night and that's it. And sometimes that's enough to just keep me going, that I'm getting a little bit of progress. I'm not moving towards anything. I don't have any events or anything like that, like Paul said. So I'm kind of in the same mode as you. But I find if I ever stop and go like a couple of days without doing any hobby, chances are I'll go a week or two without doing any hobby after that. And so the best mode I've found is to just do a little bit every night, even if it's just half an hour.
Like a shark, like when just keep swimming.
Yeah, you can't stop, keep swimming. You know, it might be that's how I live my life as well. But I definitely echo those sentiments. Once I hit the wall with things, especially when I've been painting the same army for a certain amount of time, like I hit such a wall with Guard. I don't know if I'll ever paint another Guard unit. or model because of how hard.
Those are strong words, man.
I know, and it's really strong. Hey, look, I got 10,500 points. If I ever need any new models done, it's because they've released new models. So, you know, there'll be some impetus there. But yeah, I held myself so tight to that grindstone to get all that army done. And was painting nothing but guardsmen every single night pretty much for the better part of 3 years. Because I've got something like 250 infantry just by themselves and scions and on top of that and, you know, special weapons on top of that. And yeah, that was I don't know if I can go back now. You know, you ever had a tequila hangover and someone offers you a shot of tequila? it feels like that. Even after a couple of years, someone's like, "Ah, oh, cool. You want to paint some new guard models because the Cadian heads came out." I'm like, no, drink bring pain, guard bring pain. Can't go back. Yeah, and so I've done my best to never let myself burn out like that again. Because yeah, I don't like it. I don't like that. I had this. It's my favorite army that I own. My guard army is my favorite army. I don't like that. I look at it and never want to paint them again. Or don't want to improve them. Don't want to fix them or touch them up. And I feel like eventually they'll get neglected. And I don't like that feeling. So I'm gonna have to get back. I'm gonna have to get that mojo back some point.
I'm sure that you can put some gill in the flesh on their faces. You know, there's another reason to go back.
I want to hiss at you.
Well, so what you're describing, though, you know, at least from the first part of getting it done, or the way that you approached this little kind of the way you digest some of your hobby time and stuff, that works for you. And I think at least what I believe, and I do believe this, is that something like that works for everyone. There's a way that we can kind of keep ourselves moving and motivated, and even if it's just small things, like very small things. There's if you're able to get anything done, a lot of people talk about, oh, just 1 hour a night, just do 1 hour a night. But if you even got one brushstroke a night, then at some amount of time later, you will have something more than what someone who didn't do that was. And that, I mean, look, you know, I got buddies that don't paint their models. I paint their models for them, but that's the thing. They'll never have them. They do other things. They, you know, other areas of the hobby. That's their thing. But I'm just meaning if when you're going through this progress, sometimes it can be a slog. And if you're starting a new project and you don't want that project to live on your shelf forever, you want to be able to actually use it, do the thing you set out to do when you got it in the first place, then, you know, some of these tips and tricks, or at least knowing that other people, yeah, I don't know if it's misery loves company or whatever, but other people out there are facing the same challenges. It's kind of a way to get past those challenges.
Dude, fair. Some good points in there as well. Do you find momentum's a thing in hobbying, like in painting and stuff? Because I think that's what I'm talking about. I need to have some level of momentum at all times. If I ever come to a dead stop, I find it hard to start again. Like the train I'm carrying is too much baggage. And if it ever should ever stop, the train is not sure it has the horsepower to move again, so to speak.
For me, it's like on both ends. So when I'm staring down, there's a ton of things to get done. It's like, oh, well, there's a ton of things. Where do I even start? Or when I'm staring at one model, like, oh, it'll be there. I could do it. I could do that in 5 hours.
Yeah, true.
But then I never put in the first hour because I know it's just always waiting. It's always just right there. I could just do it. I could do it over the course. Oh, I could just get up on Saturday morning, edit the show, and then paint that figure because that strategy's worked out for the last 4 months. You know what I mean? Like there's it's just that kind of stuff that we can do. And I don't know that I'm being honest, even though, yes, I can sit down and paint it in 5 hours or 6 hours. I don't know that I'm being honest with myself that I will do that without figuring out a way to get moving.
No, totally agree, dude.
Yeah. But it's one of those, it's going to, the way we get to that, to the end result of showing up at an event with a fully painted army is going to be different for as many people that could be there.
Yeah. I love how in our community as well, and it's the opposite of not wanting to know how the sausage is made. Everyone's willing to tell everybody about how hard they crunched to get their army done. And like, oh man, I stayed up until 2 o'clock in the morning last night because I needed to get the bases done, blah, blah, blah. And then there's that smug dude who walks past being like, I had a good night's sleep. My army was done 2 months ago.
What a jerk.
I know.
But this is, you know, as especially with new armies coming out, people, like things that people are going to be excited about, especially orcs and stuff. It's like, I think it's going to be potentially easy with maybe fewer events of getting overwhelmed. And maybe now, not everyone, like people like, Paul, what are you talking about? Like I get the box, I bring it home, I build the squad, and I don't get another squad until that one's done. You know, that's certainly one way of doing it.
Yeah. That's some hella discipline you got right there.
Yeah. But that is not my behavior. sucks.
It used to be mine when I was poor. That was what I did, and I told myself I'd continue doing that when I wasn't poor anymore and had a good paying job. That didn't happen.
Well, for me, and I don't want to. This is not like a, you know, a statement of opulence or whatever. But you know, I will definitely think, oh well, I know I'm going to need those three elite slots. I already know that I'm going to want to use them. So let me just go ahead and get them. And then, you know, what that does is creates a stack that you then mm-hmm. have to spend some hobby time with. And I just mean, you know,
yeah.
And I think it's easy to get frustrated with yourself when it's not coming together as quickly as you want it to.
Yeah.
And just figuring out some strategies to when that happens to come up, figuring out some strategies so you eventually do get it done and don't get frustrated with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I agree with.
That's yeah. Getting frustrated is the worst thing, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, these hobby segments, you know, about, and maybe, you know, not trying to beat it up here, but just being really realistic with yourself, I think will help keep you moving to, like, to your point, taking off digestible chunks until you get the same result. And, you know, the only race you're against is yourself or things you put for yourself.
Yeah. And I mean, it's horses for courses. As soon as I got decently proficient at an airbrush. Yeah. At airbrushing, my ability to push out, you know, it was no longer that I wanted to get one squad done at a time. I wanted to get, you know, 400-500 points together and get all the undercoats, base coats done on the same day. But then I'd take my sweet time getting everything else done. Like, you know, and then I would just break it down from there and just start doing one squad at a time. And so it is kind of horses for courses, and just, you know, you can do the same thing with a lot of contrasts as well. You can just slap out all your base coats in an evening on a larger squad of things. It all depends on your mode and your skill level and where you're at and what you want out of it. But man, there's nothing as quite as satisfying as like a unit you're really excited to use on the table. The last stroke you do on the last model in that squad or that unit or that character, there's nothing quite as satisfying. And then having, you know, this character's got all this potential to bring joy to your hobby life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the joy in the hobby life is a good note to end on for this episode.
Beautiful.
Yeah, man. Well, thanks for joining me. Red, thank you for being on the first part of the show. And thank y'all for listening. Please leave comments, leave 5-star reviews, like, share, and subscribe. And I know that the situation that we were just talking about is not the same thing for everybody, but I think we all experience something like that along our journey in the hobby.
Yeah, for sure.
Figure it's best to talk about it.
Yeah, why not?
Break it open, all these trials and tribulations about our hobby.
All right, mate.
Have a great rest of your evening, man. We'll see y'all next week.
Will do. See you then.
Craft worlds are sentient beings. These hosts are not. Better luck next time, monkeys!